Good morning to each of you. Often, excuse me, when you're teaching students composition, writing compositions, particularly research reports and papers, one of the things that students struggle with is to choose the correct scope of a report. Often they are such a broad scope, the subject that they choose is so broad that it would take several thousand words. And then also the opposite is sometimes true, that they choose such a narrow topic that it is a struggle to get the required amount of words written for the report. I managed to make the same mistake. I chose much too broad of a topic, and so this is a shortened and condensed version of my topic. But before Christmas, for the Threads class that I give, which is the third through fifth graders, we looked at some of the early Mennonite and Anabaptist history. And I discovered that I do not know nearly as much about that topic as I thought I did. And so that is what we're going to be looking at this morning. We're going to be looking at the Mennonite church history, and we're just going to focus on the approximately the first century. So, and I'm going to run this more like a class than a sermon because that's what I'm more comfortable with. Does anyone know what started the Reformation period? The Reformation is generally considered to have started when Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the church door of Wittenberg in Germany in 1517. At that time period, church doors were often used as bulletin boards. Not many of the people could read, but those that could were able to read to the others, and since everyone went to church, everyone saw things on the church door. So the church door was where you would put things like wedding announcements, birth announcements, that sort of thing. These 95 theses were 95 points or topics for discussion within the Catholic Church. In particular, some of the more inflammatory ones was the concept of justification by faith alone, and particularly the one that we remember is the sale of indulgences. The Catholic Church had a stance that priests could and were the only people and the only way to forgive sin, and that they could, by using the accumulated extra faith of the saints, they could basically spend that accumulated extra faith and erase sins from other people. And the church was allowing specific people, specific priests, to sell this spiritual favor called indulgences to allow people to either erase sins for themselves or possibly shorten the amount of time that a person that had already died spent in purgatory before they could move on to heaven. In Luther's area, this was mostly done by a man named Johann Tetzel. Now, supposedly, this money that was being raised by selling indulgences was going to help fund the building of St. Paul's Cathedral in what is now the Vatican City. However, what was not being mentioned at the time, that only about half of the money was going to that, the other half was going to certain people who had purchased their offices in the church, and that was going to pay that. Luther was against this sale of indulgences, and he sparked the beginning of the Reformation, a great change in church history, and the splitting from one church, the Catholic Church in Europe, to many of the denominations that we know today. So that was in 1517 with Martin Luther. Moving on to 1519, we see a man named Ulrich Zwingli come to the scene. He became pastor of the Grossmünster Church in Zurich, and I see a couple of smiles. A couple of my students remember that. It is the largest church in Zurich. Zwingli was influenced by Luther's teachings, but they did clash. specifically on the nature of the sacraments and whether Christ was there specifically or not, which is much too complicated to really get into. But they became bitter, not quite rivals, but they definitely clashed on this issue. Along with the things that Luther preached against, Zwingli also preached against church corruption, and also the Swiss practice of sending out mercenary soldiers. Unlike most of the people in this time period, Zwingli was supported by the church the city leaders of Zurich, and he was able to essentially create a closely aligned church and state in the city of Zurich. This preaching, these teachings of Luther and Zwingli, essentially served to stir up a lot of the lower classes who believed that along with this change in spiritual matters, there should be a change in social and economic matters, and we have the Peasants' War starting in 1524. Where peasants attempted to overthrow the remaining chains of serfdom. And Luther actually found himself on the side of the nobles against the peasants. He preached that church reform was independent of these other types of reforms, and approximately 100,000 peasants were killed in this peasants' war, and the revolt was put down. And what we will see, a lot of this early stuff before the true beginning of Anabaptism is Luther, Zwingli, several others were not non-resistant. We will see that several times here. And indeed, Zurich, with Zwingli kind of at the helm, attempted to force Protestantism on its neighboring Catholic cantons Cantons are the Swiss equivalent of states. They, at this time, were semi-independent, and the leader of each canton was supposed to be able to choose what faith their canton practiced, whether Catholic or Protestant, which at this point were essentially the two options in Europe. Zurich attempted to expand Protestantism, shall we say. This led to the Second War of Cappel, in 1531, between Protestant and Catholic cantons. Zwingli actually died in this war while serving as chaplain. Luther said that it was punishment from God due to him being wrong about the sacraments. In 1525, we see the beginning of the Anabaptist movement, which is part of the Reformation, but not quite the same. The Anabaptists began in Zurich in 1525. Anabaptist was a derogatory term. The people called themselves either Brethren or Swiss Brethren. The Anabaptist movement was begun by mostly a group of college students who were studying under Zwingli in Zurich. There had been a series of debates in Zurich. But with Zwingli having the backing of the church and the state, Zwingli always won these debates, whether he actually did or not. A group of students had met on the evening of January 21st to discuss the recent debates, the most recent debate, which had been held on January 17th, which discussed the issue of infant baptism. This group of mostly men concluded that infant baptism was not biblical. And on the evening of January 21st, again that's 1525, George Blaurock requested that Conrad Grebel baptize him as a consenting adult. This was done, and then Blaurock baptized all the others present. And so I wanted to briefly look at what happened to the most prominent of these men at this gathering. Felix Mons, whose house this meeting was held in, Felix Mons was one of the first Anabaptist martyrs. He was drowned on January 5th, 1527. That is approximately 2 years after he was baptized. Both the verdict and the sentence of death were supported by Zwingli, who had once been his teacher as well as a close friend. At the same time that Mons was drowned, George Blaurock was beaten and expelled from Zurich. A couple months later, in April 1527, he was banished from Switzerland altogether. He moved to Tyrol, which is a city in northern Italy, and established a successful ministry there. However, he was arrested and tortured and eventually burned at the stake on September 6, 1529. Conrad Grebel was arrested in October 1525, so he was arrested only a few months, about 10 months after his baptism. However, he managed to escape prison in March of 1526. He died in either July or August of the same year of the plague. Before we move on from this opening act, one might say, one interesting fact I found was that the Swiss Brethren believed that singing to praise God should only be done in the heart, not out loud. Particularly Grebel was against any sort of corporate singing in church and clashed with those who believed otherwise. One of the things I struggled with as I studied for this, I tried to keep it in chronological order, the events as I am reading them. However, things were happening very close to the same times in multiple different places. So in order to stay in a chronological timeline, we are going to jump around quite a bit in a geographic sense. And so we are going to move to Moravia. The land of Moravia is part of the modern-day Czech Republic. We have a man there named Leonhard von Liechtenstein. He was baptized as an Anabaptist, and his lands became a refuge for persecuted Anabaptists around Europe. One of the issues that developed among these different Anabaptist peoples living on Liechtenstein's land was whether it was appropriate to bear arms in defense of a godly leader. In fact, they were eventually split into two camps, one who believed it was biblical to bear the sword in defense of a godly leader like Liechtenstein, while the others became known as staff bearers instead of sword bearers, and they did not believe, they were non-resistance no matter the cause. In 1528, the non-resistant group was expelled from Liechtenstein's city and land. This group numbered about 200 adults plus children, and it was led by a man named Jacob Wiedemann. This group pooled all of their earthly possessions after the example of the Church of the New Testament. They moved north to Austerlitz, Holland, where they also had their own internal issues and was quite fractured. Into this fractured group, a man named Jacob Hutter moved and quickly assumed a position of leadership. He was only their leader for approximately 2 years, between 1533 and 1535. However, he did lend his name to their group, who became known as the Hutterites. Then in 1536, Jacob Hutter was arrested, taken back to Tyrol, Italy, where he had been from, and was burned at the stake. And by 1530, Anabaptism spread from the Swiss-German border as well as northern Italy. It spread down the Rhine River to the Netherlands and Holland. So at this point, I want to read one of the stories I read to my class that kind of takes the events from bare facts to a bit more of a story. So this gives us an idea of what it would have been like to be in Holland at this time. And this is called Church in the Pasture. The tinkling of cowbells echoed across the peaceful Frisian countryside. Dusk had fallen, and the summer air was heavy with the smell of drying hay. Insects hummed in the thickets between the fields, and occasional locust trebled his shrill music. Two black Frisian cattle ambled contentedly across the lush pasture field only a mile outside Leeuwarden. Now and then they paused, lowered their head, reached out long, rough tongues, and pulled off mouthfuls of grass. One cow raised her head, ears forward, as the lowing of a cow from a nearby farm drifted on the wind. She answered, a long, drawn-out moo that startled all the frogs in a nearby pool to stillness. The cows walked on, and the bells hanging from their necks tinkled a fine melody of peace and plenty. The harsh noises of the city fell softly upon the field, muffled by the distance. Then came the deep, deep tones of the tower bell in the cathedral, proclaiming the hour of nine. The low tones of the massive bell reverberated in the night air, mingling with the light tingling of the cowbells near at hand. For a moment there was a light at the edge of the pasture field, and then it disappeared. One cow turned to look, alert to anything unusual. Seconds later, the light was on again, then out once more. Footsteps drew near, and the cows began to amble off slowly. "Oh, what is it?" came a girl's voice. "Cows," answered a second voice. "Nothing to be alarmed about." A man spoke softly. "Only a little farther now, at the far end of the field, between the two thickets. That is where we are to meet tonight." The night travelers passed the cattle. Curious about the intruders, one of the cows followed them. In the party were Hannah Dirks and her two children, Elizabeth Dirks and Claes Bronger and his wife. They were on their way to an Anabaptist meeting. "I wonder if those are Uncle Jew's cows," mused Garrett, a husky young lad of 12 years. "Oh, I think not," answered his sister. "Uncle has more than two cows, and his farm is farther over that way, isn't it, Mother?" She pointed north. "Yes, you're right, Claudine," said Hannah. "Shh, I hear voices," broke in young Garrett. "Yes, we are almost there," Claes Bronger explained. A number of people were already seated on the grass, waiting in the darkness till others would arrive. They formed a semicircle facing a small thicket. In low tones they visited with each other or bowed their heads in prayer. Hannah seated herself on the ground, Garrett on one side of her and Claudine on the other. Elizabeth sat beside Claudine and began to talk with the woman on her right. "Is Menno here already?" she asked. The woman nodded her head. "He is over there, speaking with the other elders." The voice was familiar, thought Hannah. Yes, it was Andrew Clayson's widow from Drowship. She had not recognized her in the dark. "How are you, Mrs. Clayson?" asked Hannah. "Is it you, Hannah Dirks?" "That's right." "We are enjoying the blessings of the Lord, Sister Hannah. He has been good to us. It is over 7 years since Andrew was taken, you know. The boys have grown up. Two of them are brethren in the church. I know Andrew would be pleased if he were alive." "I am so glad to hear of it," Hannah said warmly. "Are these your children?" asked Mrs. Clayson. "Yes, this is Garrett and this is Claudine." The visiting and whispering suddenly stopped as the elders and ministers came over to the larger circle and sat down, facing the assembled group. One of the ministers read a chapter from the Bible, the 11th chapter of the letter to the Hebrews. The group sat under the stars, listening intently as the minister read of the heroes of the faith: Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Moses. Many hearts beat faster as he read. "And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon, and of Barak, and of Samson, and of Jephthah, of David also, and Samuel, and of the prophets. Who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had trial of cruel mockings and of scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, they were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains, in dens and caves of the earth." How like our own experiences, thought the men and women seated on the grass in the darkness. And as Menno Simon stood up to preach, he said, bonds and imprisonment are still the lot of the faithful of God. Otherwise, we would not need to meet in a field as this under the cover of darkness. But is not the night holy and pure as the day? Did not Moses and all Israel eat the Passover at night? Did Christ think it wrong to exhort Nicodemus at night? Did not the church assemble at night when Peter was in prison to pray for him? But in all this suffering, let us not grow bitter. Christ spoke to us when he said, "Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you." Only if we do this can we truly be the children of our Father in heaven. Menno paused in his preaching, and across the silent fields came the deep tones of the cathedral bell. And I think I will stop there with that for want of time. But that gives you an idea of what it was like to meet in Holland in this time period. In 1534, a group of radical Anabaptists who really only shared the concept of adult baptism with other Anabaptists took control of the German city of Münster and attempted to form an Anabaptist kingdom. The city was recaptured on June 25th of 1535, and all the radical Münsterites were killed. But this put a black mark against Anabaptists of all types in the eyes of city leaders as well as kings. That brings us to Menno Simons. Menno Simons entered the priesthood near Witmarsum, Holland. In January of 1536, Menno confessed his sins and became born again and was baptized. Within several months, he was ordained to the Anabaptist ministry by Obie Phillips. Menno Simons spent a large part of his time writing to defend the Anabaptist views and to point out the differences between the peaceful Anabaptists and the violent Münsterites. In 1544, we see the term menaced first used to describe these people. It was used in a document by a woman known as Countess Anna of Oldenburg. She was part of the Holy Roman Empire, and she was writing to defend her decision to offer the Anabaptists refuge in her region. She was eventually forced to change that by Holy Roman Emperor Charles V. She had to decree that the Anabaptists must leave her region. However, she did her best to not enforce that decree. Menaced quickly morphed into Mennonites. Menno eventually settled in the German town of Wüstenfeld. He is among a very small group of people, Anabaptist people of this time period. He died of natural causes in 1561. In 1693, I'm going to quickly go over some final details. We are accelerating through time. In 1693, a schism developed among the Swiss Brethren. The schism centered around the application of excommunication of church members. At a church conference to discuss these issues, tempers flared, and a man known as Ammon and four other ministers excommunicated the six other pastors there, and then stomped out. Although many of the ministry personally did reconcile in 1700, the two groups that followed these two different views never did, and Ammon's followers, Jacob Ammon, his followers became the Amish. Between 1717 and 1750, approximately 500 Amish moved to America, most settling in what would be known as Bucks County, Pennsylvania, although they soon moved again due to some issues related to the French and Indian War. In 1937, the last remaining European Amish church merged back into the Mennonites in Holland. As of 2010, there were about 250,000 Amish in 32 states and 4 provinces, as well as Bolivia and Argentina. The Hutterites, who we saw earlier, mostly emigrated to the United States in the 1870s and then from there into Canada. As of 2010, approximately 50,000 Hutterites live in 470 community farms across Western Canada and the Western U.S. Mennonites as a whole, as of 2018, scattered across the globe, there were 2.13 million Mennonites of all kinds.